Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. And you know what we're going to be thinking about today? We're going to at least start the show by thinking about weeds and invasive species and maybe controlling them. Our guest, Frank Hassler, he's owner and chief ecologist at Good Oak Ecological Services. He's president of the Wild Ones Madison chapter. So, talking weeds, but of course we can talk about all kinds of other things because he's got a broad range of experience to bring to the table here. So I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Frank Hassler, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. Long-time listener, first-time guest.
Yeah, it's great to have you here as a guest. And let's talk about your business, just to start with. What's it all about?
Yeah, I started Good Oak about 12 years ago now. We do ecological restoration work, and we kind of bridge the gap. We do, you know, the back 40 out in a rural property, planting prairies and doing prescribed burns. We also do landscaping with native plants closer to homes. A lot of invasive species control is part of establishing prairies and gardens. So,
And you're involved with the Wild Ones, and somebody from Wild Ones occasionally calls the show, but it's a great organization. Talk about what that group does.
Yeah, Wild Ones promotes landscaping with native plants, the indigenous plants that originally grew in your part of the world, in this part of Wisconsin. So it's a lot about promoting pollinator habitat, promoting clean water, reducing your lawn, and putting more interesting and functional plants in your landscape.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. We wanted to talk about weed and invasive species control, at least to start the show a little bit. What are some of the methods that you use for prevention?
Oh, boy, I could go on a long time about that. It really varies on what you're dealing with. I kind of break up invasive plants and weeds into their life histories. So an annual or a biennial, their goal, the way they reproduce, is by producing a lot of seeds. And so your goal there is to prevent them from doing that. And that might mean simply pulling. That might mean with a lot of biennials, we use herbicide to spot spray in the first year before they get that second year growth. Mm-hmm. You can clip them, bag them, mow them, all sorts of stuff like that. Perennial weeds are a bit more problematic, so that would mean things like thistles, Canada thistle, or reed canary grass, or you might look at woody perennials like buckthorn or honeysuckle. With those plants, you really got to kill the root. So on a small scale, you can dig some of those roots out. On a larger scale, a lot of times it means careful application of herbicide.
But regardless, there's usually a bit of work associated with it.
Yeah, it always is, any way you go about it.
No question. Mo in Ocano has something for us, so let's go there. Hi, Mo.
Hey, guys. Hey, Frank.
Hi.
My question is this. Stabilizing a riverbank, and we're talking, there's kind of some riprap there, but I have some trees growing, which I believe is helping, and some brush. What can a guy do to help stabilize the bank so it doesn't slide into the river, so you can keep your river deep? And is there certain trees or plants that do well in that wet footprint?
Yeah. Well, rivers are such dynamic systems. They can be pretty complex. Sometimes there's not a lot you can do because the power of the river really overpowers what you can do. If, you're on the outside of an oxbow, something like that, it's just going to carve in there. And then, of course, with the way we develop our landscape, a lot more water is flushing into rivers and streams, and then climate change seems to be exacerbating that. But I will say, actually, what has been found is that deep-rooted perennials do a much better job of holding the soil than woody plants. If you imagine a tree root is big and thick and coarse, but you don't really think about a lot of small fibrous roots when you're thinking about trees and shrubs. So what we are promoting is a lot of these native grasses that have deep roots. Some of these roots go 10 or 15 feet down, sedges, and some of the perennials to mix in there. And what you find in those environments is you get this prairie sod, this dense network of roots that does a much better job of holding and stabilizing things.
Yeah.
Some specific examples, there are... if it's higher, a little higher up the slope, you might use some of the tall prairie grasses like Indian grass or big bluestem. Closer to the water, you might be looking at cord grass. You might be looking at some of the sedges. There's a long list of sedges. Mm-hmm. But and then, you know, mix that in with some attractive flowering plants, too, to provide a wider range of habitat or deep-rooted things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That makes sense. Makes good sense. Mo, does that help?
That helps. Thanks, Frank.
Sure.
Yeah, appreciate the call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Maureen had called in to ask what she could do, what she can use on weeds instead of Roundup.
Yeah. Well, it kind of depends on your weed. There are some broadleaf specific herbicide weeds. Herbicides that you could try instead. Like we look for things with the active ingredient triclopyr. It's a pretty safe chemical. I don't want to get into the whole Roundup debate today.
Yeah.
It's a big thing. I don't believe from a lot of the research, and I have done a lot of research, that it is as unsafe as certain sources are stating. I think if you look at the broad consensus of science, it's not that unsafe. If you're looking for more organic control methods, it really depends. There are actually some quote-unquote organic herbicides that are based on citric acid or acetic acid, which is vinegar. And those aren't really good at deep-rooted perennials or maybe not your best thing for controlling thistles, but they might help you with your dandelions, your garlic mustard, your more weakly rooted species.
There we go. Dean in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Dean.
Hey, I was wondering if you could tell me about, I have some ornamental conifers, and last summer I trimmed them a little bit. You know, they were growing out of shape. These are the ones that are usually, they have like round parts to them. Anyways, I trimmed them, and then I got a little dieback. They turned to brown. So this winter I protected them from the wind. I mean, I know sometimes they get killed from the freeze in the winter. So now I guess that what I want to know is when is the best time to trim them? And then do I cut that what is died out right now? And then what do I do to get them to come back and be happy again as far as fertilizing or anything like that?
Well, I'll say that's not my area of expertise. I do have a little bit. I know a few things about this. First of all, bad news is once a twig or a branch or needles die back on a conifer, those things are not
coming back.
Yeah, not coming back from those growing points. So anywhere you've got die back, you might as well prune that back because those are gone. You know, it could be what affected it in the first place, could be a huge number of things, diseases, pests, soil conditions. I'd check with the UW Extension and try to figure out what particular evergreen you have and, you know, see what diseases and issues relate to that. As far as pruning goes, usually it's for conifers, it's usually kind of in the fall, but you can do it in the winter too. I don't know if Larry might have some more resources on
that. Well, you can certainly do it now. Dead stuff could go
anytime.
Anytime. It really wouldn't make any difference. You might want to wait and see what is really dead and what's not, and which would should be able to tell that now.
Yeah, usually, some of them have flexible twigs. Some of them, you know, if they snapped, obviously they're dead. Some species stay pretty flexible even after they die. So you can try to test some of that.
And you could take a look at the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. Mm-hmm. Send a photo to Brian Huddleston. If you got just with your phone, you can send a couple of pictures. And he may be able to help. If he thinks it's a maybe insect problem, he'll send it to PJ Leash in the insect diagnostic lab. They're like one floor apart in the building. So that is something you can do, and typically you'll get an answer pretty quick back from him. If you've got some good photos of those, maybe a long shot and then a couple of close-ups, they can do quite a bit of good. Dean, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or go ahead and email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's see. Erica emailed to say she and her husband moved into their first home in December in Ashland, Wisconsin. Wonderful place. Mm-hmm. They're very excited to garden this upcoming season. They want to start to plant natives only. However, they're unfamiliar with native shrubs and flowers that would be best for the Ashland area.
Yeah, well, that's a little bit out of the geographical zone I normally work in. So I'm sitting here reading and thinking about some resources you could utilize. The UW Arboretum does have some resources on native plants. Again, it's more focused on the southern half or southern two-thirds of the states. You could check in with the closest Wild One chapter. We're going to mention them. Wildones.org is the organization, and that's a native landscaping group that I earlier mentioned I'm involved in. And they will have a chapter near you that you can get some information from some of those folks. And there are, you'll have to check around with what nurseries focus on native plants. And I'm afraid I'm not familiar all the way up in Ashland. I know some a little further south, but,
Yeah, and there's a couple of other ways you could go too. Master Gardener program up there is a very good program. Lots of really good folks there. And, for your county, you can, they're online, you can find that pretty easy. And the UW horticulture educator for Dan, for that county also, or for the, he's in for, I think, two or three counties in that area. He would be a great source. So if you go to your county UW Extension office, get the number and call.
And I wouldn't be surprised if someone, if there's some resources at Northland College there.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Check in with some of those folks.
I just did an interview with one of the guys from Northland, and they have an excellent, excellent group of people there, for sure. So lots of sources there for you, Erica, and I hope you have some luck. I know you will. You're not going to have to go very far to find it.
Yeah.
Reggie in Oshkosh, it's your turn. Hi, Reggie.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, appreciate the call.
Me and my wife are buying a house in Oshkosh, and all the lawn there is just weeds, and they're very strongly rooted there, and it's all topsoil that's just been dumped on top of the clay-like earth that's there, and I don't know what to do to fix that. We just want lawn and maybe a couple of raised garden beds.
Yeah. You know, my usual solution for problem lawns is to eliminate the lawn and put in some perennials, native perennials if you can. But to deal with the lawn in particular, first of all, I want to put a word in for the weeds. Things like dandelions, creeping charlie, and we'll see, not purslane. Well, purslane, but I'm thinking plantain. You know, those are all things we consider undesirable in the lawn, but they're really pretty harmless ecologically or even in gardens, although I can tell you pulling the creeping charlie out of my beds can be a bit of work in the spring. But they do provide a little bit of wildlife value. You know, they're not native plants. They're not what I promote. But if you think about Kentucky bluegrass, doesn't really feed anything, doesn't really provide habitat for anything. Some of those weeds, creeping charlie, plantain, that kind of stuff, creeping charlie in particular is really valuable for bumblebee queens when they emerge in the spring. There's not a lot of plants available for them.
It's the only one that's flowering.
Yeah, exactly. So just a little word for, you know, accepting some of those weeds can actually have benefits. What I usually promote is, I'm not a lawn guy, but what I'll say is let your lawn grow a little longer. A 4-inch lawn is going to, the grass is going to do better. Be less drought stressed than if you mow it down to 2 inches all the time. It'll do a better job competing with those weeds. And, you know, soil use fertilizers might help. And, you know, watering as needed. But, yeah, that's about my.
Yeah, a good lawn, just letting that grass get up there 3-4 inches. Four is good.
Yeah. People tend to scalp it real low. It might want it to look tidy, but that's not very healthy for the plants. And that also reflects how deep the roots are able to get.
So it's something to think about, Reggie. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Richard in Potosi. Your turn, Richard. Hi.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about control of reed canary grass. I have a prairie restoration in southwestern Wisconsin, which recently got rather destroyed by a flooding of the creek that passes through, and reed canary grass moved in very quickly. I'm reluctant to use any kind of chemical herbicide because the creek is home for an endangered frog, the Blencher cricket frog, and I'm concerned with the runoff. I'm interested in any ideas you have of setting back, knocking back the canary grass. Will cord grass outcompete it, or any sedges outcompete it if I try to reintroduce them, or what would you suggest?
Yeah, so can you tell me a little bit, so this is kind of the floodplain of the stream, but it's not seasonally wet, it gets wet when it floods, is that what you're dealing with?
Well, the creek turned into a raging river about a year ago.
Yeah.
and took out the banks and flooded an area, and it's intermittently flooded, it's much more of a wet area than it was before.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wanting to control it and restore some sort of probably a wet mesic prairie or something, even a wetland, but yeah. I've got to get rid of the reed canary grass before I can do anything. So.
Yeah. Your reed canary grass is a tough one. So a couple things you can do, and assuming it's kind of mixed in with some other stuff, if it's not the only thing growing there, prescribed burning can help, especially a well-timed, a later season prescribed burn. You want that reed canary grass to be up, 6 inches, 8 inches or so. So it's putting energy into forming leaves, and you burn it and you take all that root energy away. That can help a lot. If it's dry enough to mow it when it starts flowering in June, getting out there and knocking it down during that time period really is helpful. And interseeding, with some of the aggressive native kind of wetland edge plants. There's actually something put out by Natusa Grassland, which is going to be south of us in Illinois. If you look up Way of the Warrior reed canary grass, if you Google that, there's a great, I think it's a PDF document that the folks at Natusa developed that will have a list of about a half dozen, including cordgrass species that will compete well with reed canary grass. So annual burning, summer mowing. And then as far as, concern about herbicide in that, there are some aquatic-approved herbicides that are going to be safe with those sorts of organisms, like frogs. Roundup, for example, straight Roundup has some of the inactive ingredients are not safe for amphibians. But they make aquatic-approved versions of glyphosate, that's the active ingredient in that, that won't really be harmful. We find that a really late-season herbicide application, late October, November, maybe even December if you get some warm weather, can really focusly target and kill reed canary grass, which is still green at that time, and most of our native plants have gone dormant. So if you were going to do that, that can be the time frame to look at.
There you go, Richard. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Our guest today is Frank Hassler. He's the owner and chief ecologist at Good Oak Ecological Services and also president of the Wild Ones Madison chapter. I'm Larry Mueller, Nigel O'Shea, our engineer, Jill Nadeau, our producer, and you are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Zeroed in a bit on weed and invasive species control here on the Ideas Network, but we're taking some other questions as well with our guest, Frank Hassler of Good Oak Ecological Services and president of the local Wild Ones chapter. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along. Melissa in Black River Falls has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Melissa.
Yes. Hi, how are you today?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, you were talking about Creeping Charlie, and I don't know exactly what Creeping Charlie is, but I assume that's what I have going on in our front lawn. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a little leaves with like a purplish flower.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it started out little, and now it's gotten big. How do you get, I guess there's nothing wrong with having it there, but it's overtaken one part of the lawn. So how do I even think about stopping that? Or what do I do so it's not my whole lawn?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, first of all, usually Creeping Charlie is problematic in wetter soils or in shadier sites. You can imagine shadier sites, that broad leaf is going to collect sunlight better than a narrow grass leaf. And it's just a little better adapted to wet conditions than lawn grass is. So that might be kind of what's instigating the problem. You might be having to work against that kind of, if you want to call it, natural competition. So if you do want to get rid of it, I think mechanical control, that is to say using a rake to kind of rake it out or hand pull it out, can actually work pretty well if you're diligent. Start at the edges and work towards the interior, and you'll get the best control. But it doesn't take much to break that up, especially when it comes out in the spring or in the fall.
Yeah, I've often mentioned on the show, I get my daughter out there in the spring on our lawn, and you'd be surprised in a half hour how much creeping Charlie mm-hmm. you can get rid of. And then you're not going to get all of it, but then if you mow high, mm-hmm. you're mowing at 3.5-4 inches,
yeah.
it pretty much knocks it way back.
Yeah.
In your case, if it happens to be a shady area, then you might want to consider some overseeding with some more shade-tolerant grass species that are going to compete
better.
And
that
fescues,
sort of thing.
Yeah, for sure. Melissa, does that help?
Yeah, it does help. Thank you. How do you, let's say, okay, in the flower beds, though, so
yeah.
like it gets, you know, under, we kind of let the front flower bed kind of jungle-like, I kind of yeah. describe it like daylilies and your, you know, all your flowers, and you just let them grow, but that's underneath all that. How do you keep that once you get it out then? How do you keep it from coming back, or is it just something you persistently got to be pulling at?
Yeah, it's just going to happen all.
Yeah. It sounds like my brother's flower bed, actually, in front of his house. And, you know, I have a daughter 6 years old now, so we had a couple of years there where we had a little garden decline, and we let a big part of our perennial bed get taken over. And it was a lot of work that first time to get, you know, just going yeah. in there by hand or with, you know, rake or something and getting that out. But you get so much of out. Most of the biomass in Creeping Charlie's above ground. So if you can get that above ground portion out of there, the next time will be less work, and next time will be less and less as you go on.
Yeah. Just keep at it a little bit, Melissa. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. I hope you will at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we have John in Chippewa Falls.
Hi.
Hi, John.
A question's about the buckthorn, the woody shrub tree thing. I've girdled it and had some success. I've also heard you can cut it down and then put some stuff on the stump that mm-hmm. will kill it. There's a lot of it around here.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the worst.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's kind of, this time of year it's my bread and butter. We like to deal with that in the winter when all the native plants, you know, desirable plants are dormant, and any, you know, physical or chemical impact you might have is going to be negligible. So what we usually do is we cut them down as close to the ground as we can, and then we do apply herbicide to the stump. You can go to the hardware store and get some of your Brush Brigand type stuff. Make sure it's stump killer level. You're not doing a foliar. You're not spraying it on the leaves. We use a product. The chemical name we use is called Triclopyr. It's a good one to look for in the ingredient list. And we use a product called Garlon 4. You can also use, there is something, a ready-to-use product called Pathfinder 2, which is also has that triclopyr in it. And honestly, you can go and get concentrate around that Roundup or another generic from that with that glyphosate as a primary ingredient. Mix it one-to-one with water. But cutting those things down and treating the stumps is very effective at killing them. You can use the Garlon or the Pathfinder to chemically girdle, and that is to carefully spray it just on the bark there, kind of towards the base. Of course, then you're stuck with an ugly, dead-looking buckthorn, but
yeah.
at least it's dead. Good news is buckthorn makes great firewood, so you got any pieces big enough for that, it'll high BTU wood. And you can either use it in a fire, or you can do, we use a lot of brush piles to consume the wood when there's a lot of it.
And you probably want to make that application. You make the cut, then you make the application.
Yep.
Don't come back the next day and do that.
Yeah, you can get away with that a little bit with the Garlon, but we tend to just, you miss stumps. You forget, you can't find
yeah.
them all. So our rule with my team is that we are, if you cut it, you treat it, and you treat it, you know, within a minute or two of cutting, so you don't lose track.
Yep, that makes sense. Does that help, John?
Yeah, you do this right away soon. They're the first thing to leaf out in the spring,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So you do it right as soon as you can see them?
Like I said, we do it in the winter. You still have a few weeks here before the sap really starts flowing. You can still get going to it. You can do it. There's a period kind of when the sap's really heavily flowing right before leaf buds out and into kind of mid-May where it just doesn't work.
It doesn't work.
But once you get full leaf out in May, you could start up again and work on it then all the way through, you know, March the next year. I will say for those people that want to avoid the chemical use, I once got away where I timed it just right accidentally when I was in high school. They leafed out, and I went out there with a friend, and we cut all this buckthorn in my parents' backyard in middle, late May. And it was just that period right after the leaves came out, and those little, you can't even notice them, the little green flowers were blooming. And again, that plant had put all that energy into putting the leaves out and putting the flowers out. And we cut them down, and they just died. They didn't have enough root reserves left. So sometimes that can work if you're looking at organic control. And then re-clipping, you know, if it does re-sprout, clip them down once they leaf out again and keep up with it. Don't let them stay green for long. Get them early. And you can exhaust them eventually.
All right. There you go, John. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. Ben emailed that he's dealing with reed canary grass with herbicide Aquanet or Rodeo brand.
Yep.
Herbicides. They're safe to use with aquatic life like frogs and fish. You mentioned fall applications. He says he's had excellent results spraying in early spring.
Mm-hmm.
Also, reed canary is the first grass to start growing before the native plants are growing, and so you won't kill the natives. And then he added that many sedge varieties, you must be careful with some of them as they stay green.
Yeah, Ben nailed everything right there. You know, sometimes what I say with reed canary grass is it's really, you know, mowing alone isn't going to do it. Burning alone isn't going to do it. Herbicide alone isn't going to do it. You got to really use all three of those things throughout the growing season. So, you know, you could do an early spring burn and then a herbicide treatment after that. Or, you know, if you aren't burning, you could try to spray it early. I think mowing mid-season is really helpful for weakening the roots so that it's more susceptible to the burning and the herbicide later in the season. Yeah, I think he's nailed it.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about prescribed burning. You're mentioning it here, and there are a lot of benefits, as you're sort of describing.
Yeah. Yeah, generally speaking, in the southern half of the state, just about every plant in every plant community is adapted to fire to some level or another. You know, if you get into your maple-dominated woodlands, those didn't burn very often, but they did on occasion. But it's a really important maintenance thing for oak woodlands, prairies, savannas, wetlands, wetlands probably throughout the state even. And these plants are adapted to fire. They're adapted to recovering quickly. The fire kind of recycles nutrients into the soil, and that allows those plants to retake those nutrients rather than like the time period it takes for, you know, grass leaves to break down and recycle the nutrients that way. And a lot of native plants are not adapted to fire. Reed canary grass is green at a time when things are very flammable. Garlic mustard as well is, you know, green at a time that's not flammable. Buckthorn little seedlings are easily killed by a woodland fire in an oak woodland or something like that. So it kind of really balances the equation. It really forces things towards benefiting all the natives and against the invasive things.
And, you know, there are some legalities associated with it as well. Maybe comment on them. I think that may vary a bit depending on where you are.
Yeah, you know, it's we're doing a lot of burn planning right now. So it's I'm dealing, you know, I only deal with kind of Dane and surrounding counties, you know, maybe a 6-county area. And I've got like a 4-page document of all the different, you know, legalities. So check with your local fire department. Check with the DNR in your area. Much of the state is regulated by that. A lot of the state, I mean, essentially kind of north of the Military Ridge or north of the Wisconsin River, you're required to get an annual burn permit. And if you're going to do the burn on your own, you're required to do it after 6 p.m. and under 10 acres in size. Otherwise, you need to get a special permit and probably need to call in a contractor to help with that. Sometimes the local fire department will do it. It always doesn't hurt to talk to them. I guess I urge people, like, we need more people doing prescribed burn for the health of the landscape, but we need people that know what they're doing.
Yeah.
So I usually recommend, you know, work with a contractor if it's, you know, private land. Work with a contractor at least a few times and learn the ropes before you attempt it on your own. Or go out and volunteer with a group like Prairie Enthusiasts, and they do burns all spring. You know, they're throughout the Driftless and the southern half of the state, even up into Minnesota. And, you know, if you go on volunteers and learn how it's done a little bit, you can become proficient with it and then hopefully safely apply that.
Yeah, it's really a good thing. Neil in Chautauqua, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Neil. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I am curious about the prickly ash, the gentleman just called in and talked about, you guys talked about Garland 4 and Pathfinder. Mm-hmm. I have a, I actually live on the Red Cedar River, and I have an island mm-hmm. in the river that is getting covered with prickly ash.
Mm-hmm.
So are those products safe for aquatics, like, you know, fish and turtles and whatever? Or what's the best approach there on prickly ash to keep it from spreading over onto the land?
Yeah, tough situation. Well, I'll say those products I just mentioned, the Pathfinder, the Garland, are very effective on prickly ash. The thing about prickly ash is, first of all, it is a native plant, and it has a place in our system. It is actually the only thing that giant swallowtail butterfly caterpillars can feed on in Wisconsin. There might be some, I think wafer ash might also fall into that category, but it's pretty much the only source of those big, beautiful butterfly caterpillars. So there are some desirable things about it, but it does get out of control. It often responds positively to a history of grazing because it's thorny. The cows don't want to eat those thorns, and it gets out of control. So you got to balance that out, first of all. If you're dedicated to control it, if you're not near water, I would recommend, yeah, Garland 4, Pathfinder, those oil-based triclopyr formulations really translocate through the root system. When you're dealing with a prickly ash colony, you're dealing with one organism with one big root system, or maybe two or three organisms with a couple big root systems. So every stem you cut is kind of affecting the others, but if you only cut some and you don't treat them with herbicide or you only cut a portion of it, the rest of that colony, the rest of that organism is going to feed and it's going to respout rapidly. If you're closer to water,
which he is,
yes. If you're closer to water, my recommendation would be to use Garland 3A. The A stands for aquatic approved, or I'm blanking on the other. Avastland, I think, is the other name for products that are aquatic approved, and those do a pretty good job of translocating through the root system as well.
So, but you need to hit the whole thing.
Yeah, it's all or nothing for the most part.
Yeah. Neil, does that help?
Yeah, what was the last product that you mentioned?
Vastland.
Vastland.
Oh. Yep. Not with a D. V-A-S-T-L-A-N.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I did not know about the giant swallowtail butterfly caterpillar, so yeah, awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You ever deal with native cactus at all? Kurt in Deerfield emailed and wondered, where the heck can he get native cactus?
Yeah, you know, there are one or two species of prickly pear that are native to Wisconsin. And I got mine because I had I knew somebody in Sauk County that had a whole bunch, and she dug it up and brought me a box of it, and I stuck it in pots. So once you do have it, they reproduce vegetatively very easily. You can cut those pads off and stick them in the soil, and they'll root in. As far as getting some, you know, I would start checking with some of the local nurseries. I bet you could check Bluestem Farm and Baraboo. You're in Deerfield, you might check maybe Radke or Johnson's Nursery, possibly Prairie Nursery. I don't know if he does those or not.
I don't think he does, but he's going to be on the show in a couple of weeks, as a matter of fact, Neil DeBoer.
Yeah. I pretty much always say don't dig plants in the wild. But this is the case. If you've got a friend that has some, taking a little bit of cutting off of one of theirs is a pretty good way to propagate it.
So there you go. And as you say, some of the commercial places may well sell them.
Yeah, yeah. They are. I can tell they're a little hard to find. We take the cutting I have, and we're cutting one for my yard and using them for Good Oaks projects. So
there you go.
I guess give us a call if you get desperate and can't find any.
Oh, man. Frank Hassler, our guest today. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we have Jerry in Waukesha up with a question, I believe. Hi, Jerry. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if anybody has had an issue, if they've had an issue with, like, it's called Mexican bamboo. It's a an invasive plant that tends to go into low, wet areas. But if you're trying to get rid of it and you have it in your area, I'd suggest using black plastic because herbicides do not work with it. So just cover the area with black plastic and leave it there for as long as you can. Might even take about a year. but eventually you'll get rid of it because it reproduces by runners and it's very invasive.
Yeah.
Mexican bamboo is another name. It's more commonly known as Japanese knotweed. And yes, it's a very difficult to control weed. There are some herbicides that will work. You can pour concentrated Roundup down. You cut them off at the ground level and you pour concentrated Roundup down the stem. There are some new herbicides. And boy, I just talked about this week. But Perspective, Milestone are pretty effective. But even those take multiple treatments over multiple years. So black plastic can work, especially if you have a small enough colony and you can cover the whole thing. As he said, it spreads by runners, though, and if you can't get the whole colony, you have a bigger problem. Yeah.
Good points, Jerry. Jerry, thank you very much for calling. Jim in Viroqua, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hello there. I was wondering about how to control burdock. I've got a bunch of burdock in an area of my property that used to be a horse pasture, and now it's just kind of growing up wild. And I got some kids that love to play in the yard, and so I'm kind of hesitant to spray too many chemicals around, and so I'm wondering what kind of options there might be. Do I just keep mowing it, or?
Yeah. The thing about, I hear this all the time in pastures, burdock, of course, those big burrs stick on fur. It's not a favored grazing plant, so the animals aren't grazing it. It just gets out of control. I think it does well in real compacted soils, too, from those hooves. If you're going to mow it, here's how you do it. You time your mowing for right when it starts to flower. What you're trying to do with burdock is exhaust its seed bank. Those things live for a year, 2 years are biennials, or they might live for 2 or 3 years and then flower, 3 or 4 years and then flower. So what you're trying to do is, if it's sprouting, you don't want to use chemicals, wait until it starts to flower. You can see that purple flower out there and go mow it down. That will have the greatest impact. It's pulling those root reserves up to produce that flower stalk, and then it may or may not resprout. And usually burdock does resprout a second time. Go and hit it again when it's flowering. Don't bother with it until it hits that point. If you can do that for several years, you ought to see the population start to diminish.
Yeah, that would be a good way to do it.
Another tool you can use if you have a smaller number of plants, a reasonable size population you can do by hand, there's a great tool the prairie enthusiasts have developed called the parsnip predator. And that severs the taproot you try to get it about 3-4 inches below the root surface. You take the root crown out, you pull that out of there. Of course, if you've got a whole field of it, you're not going to go at it that way. But if you can mow it for a few years and get that population down, that's how you can really effectively finish it off.
So where do you get that, what did you call it again?
Parsnip predator.
Oh, parsnip predator.
Yeah.
Okay.
You used to be able to get it from the Prairie Enthusiast website. They've kind of changed their website and stuff. I haven't checked in the last month if they've started selling it again. You can buy it from us at Good Oak, goodoak.com/store. And then I think Prairie Moon or Prairie Nursery also sell it. A few suppliers out there do sell them. If you're in a pinch, a sharpened spade, a real nice sharp shovel will work. But the parsnip predator is nice because it has a wedge, inverted wedge-shaped tip, so it's got kind of forks. And it makes it real easy to capture that root, whereas with a shovel, that curved shape of the slides off. And especially a real sturdy stem like burdock, it can be hard to get.
And Jim, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it very much. Our guest today, Frank Hassler, owner and chief ecologist at Good Oak Ecological Services, also president of the Madison chapter of the Wild Ones. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with Frank Hassler, owner of Good Oak Ecological Services. Hope you'll join in with your questions. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Frank, before I forget about it, I wanted to bring up some of the events. There's lots of things going on. I know you're talking at Olbrich Gardens on March 10th.
Yeah, I'll be doing a presentation there, Planting a Prairie, Choose Your Own Adventure. And I'll be discussing the various starting points and end points to get a prairie established. That's in the evening, 6 to 8.
That's March 10th.
Yes, yeah. March 10th. Yep, next week already. Mm-hmm. And then for anyone local to the Madison area, the Wild Ones, we're having a couple events coming up here. That's unfortunately that same time, March 10th, Tuesday the 10th, but at 6:30. Wild Ones is having an urban planting initiative meeting where we're trying to find places to introduce native plants and take care of some of our public spaces in the metro area here and anywhere. Mm-hmm. But for the Madison chapter. And that's going to be at the Hawthorne Branch Library in Madison, 6:30 p.m. on Tuesday the 10th of next week. And then our Wild Ones general meeting will actually be held at the Good Oak offices at 4606 Flaum Road. That's P-F-L-A-U-M Road in Madison. And we're going to have a speaker that night that'll be P.J. Oh, boy. I should practice
Leash.
This. Leash. Okay, great. Thanks. P.J. Leash from the entomology department will be talking to us about spiders. So that'd be kind of cool to learn about their role in our home landscapes.
I think PJ is scheduled to be on my show next week on Wednesday, if I'm not mistaken. Oh. I might be off on that, but...
that's a week ahead. Great. Now, let's talk about it. Let's hear what you have to say, yeah.
So there you go. A bunch of events coming up and something to just note down. In the meantime, questions for him, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Allison in La Crosse emailed that rain runs off her neighbor's driveway and a puddle forms in the corner of her basement during heavy rainstorms. What can she plant in the 3 foot of lawn between the driveway and the side of her house that will stop this from happening? Not so much of it's planting as it's lands 3 feet. You got bit to work with there in terms of mounding there, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that sort of situation where you want to regrade the site to push the water away from your house. And, of course, without seeing these, it's very hard to diagnose water issues without actually being on the ground. It's a very three-dimensional problem. Even a two-dimensional photo isn't always helpful. But regrading so that there's a flow of water, you want at least an inch per foot. If you only got 3 feet to work with, I would say you want 2 inches a drop for every foot of run away from your foundation. And once you've added that new soil, then you can start looking at, that's a great opportunity to make kind of a perennial bed there. And it's going to depend on sun, shade, and water issues, what exactly you choose.
I was thinking about my brother and sister's home that... homes settle a little bit over time and that grade goes away. Mm-hmm. My sister was having some problems at her home, and I went over there and did not a lot of grading and took care of the problem right away.
Yeah. Every landscaping project we work on, almost every time if we're working near the house, there's a grading issue we need to correct. It's amazing. Yeah.
Sherry in Richland Center, your turn. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have had a lot of problems with invasive species out here in the Driftless. The old forester at the DNR had planted a lot of autumn olive. Mm. So I had a forestry mower come in. It's the back valley where there's a lot of walnut, autumn olive. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, what would you suggest is the best way to restore that back to more native, prairie after that forestry mower came in?
Okay, so it's more prairie. It's not forested any longer. It's an open...
No, it's a back valley, and I'm thinking of putting some oak in to replace...
Sure, yeah.
It had been basically walnut had overgrown in there, autumn olive
these...
Yeah.
So it was an open field, and the walnut and the autumn olive came in. First of all, the forestry mower is a good first step, but you're going to see some resprouts and new seedlings from that autumn olive. So first round of is going to be controlling some of those weeds that come in. It's a complicated thing. I mean, if you can make it from Richland Center over to Madison next Tuesday, it might be good to discuss this in an hour and a half or 2 hour long class. But first of all is controlling some of those invasive plants. And by removing those woody invasives, you're going to be releasing a lot of ground layer weeds as well. So controlling that stuff early on, usually when we're doing prairie management for planting, we're thinking of a whole growing season of controlling weeds. That might mean you're going to have to herbicide or till to control perennial weeds, whether that's thistle or brome, reed canary grass, that kind of stuff. And mowing, again, can be pretty effective against annuals and biennials. Fall is the best time, or winter is the best time to put seeds down. They overwinter naturally. They get what they need to be ready to germinate in the spring. So kind of depending on your site, you know, whether you want to really clean sweep and till it all back in and then seed it in the fall, or whether you want to maintain some vegetation cover, even if it's weedy, and sprinkle those seeds in, you might need to interseed for a couple years until you get good establishment. That'll get you on the right track, but every site's different, and, you know, without seeing it and without, you know, sitting down for a long time and discussing options, it's hard to give you a real clear pathway.
But it's something that once that mower comes in, you need to be ready to get out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you need to be able to respond because everything's going to change as a result of that, you know, better or for worse.
Sherry, does that help?
Yes, that helps a lot. And he is going to come back and do some herbiciding, but I think I'm just going to wait, though, and, you know, after, like, try to be patient and wait a season and then put down some, like you said, in the winter, put down some seed. So I realize you have to be patient sometimes.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
So, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. You sound like a patient person, Sherry. So that's a good... It's a good trait to have when it comes to this. Gary in Boscobel, your turn. Hi, Gary.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment about fighting these invasive species like burdock and wild parsnip and almost all the non-native thistle species except Canada thistle. With most of these plants, it's important that the people battling them know the ecology of these plants, and almost all of them are biennials. Mm-hmm. And as your guest says, if you cut those when they're blooming, you really can get a good handle on them, and you may have to repeat it. But people that are fighting these need to continually tell themselves that the battle against the plant is not the battle that you need to win. It's against the seed bank that's been dropped on the ground for years and years and years. And that's really the culprit there, is trying to... get rid of the seeds there. And the only way to do that really is to let them germinate and grow and then hit them again.
Yeah.
But it doesn't take long if you know how to go about it and use their ecology against them or in your favor.
Yeah, you know, you're really trying to exhaust that seed bank, and some things last longer in the seed bank than others. You know, parsnip gets a lot of, it's a pretty scary plant because of the chemical burns you can get. But we had some clients that they just went out and mowed it and cut those seeds off, and it took them like 5 years, and they wiped it out entirely. It requires persistence. You know, you got to get those seed sources out of there, and you got to wait for them to come up. But I'll also put in a word for adding more native plants, spreading more native seeds to compete with those plants. And that's going to help control and reduce their germination rate as well.
Gary, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Chris in West Bend, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hey there. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Thanks for taking my call. So I have a question about honeysuckle, bush, honeysuckle and poison sumac. I've been battling both of them on a hillside that I've planted pine on with the sumac, and I just can't seem to win with it. And then the honeysuckle, what is the best way to deal with the honeysuckle as well?
Okay. Well, if you're dealing on a hillside, you're not at a wetland edge or in a wet spot, you're upland in a hillside, you said?
Yeah.
Okay, so you don't have poison sumac. What you're dealing with is either smooth sumac or staghorn sumac. Poison sumac is really a wetland plant, and honestly, you only find it in high-quality bogs and things like that. You almost never see it in upland areas. I mean, you never see it in upland areas. Those are native plants. Those, again, they have some value for wildlife. Those birds love the fruit. Some pollinator resources there as well, so keep that in mind. But they are aggressive, and they can spread and get out of control. That's another one where it's a clonal species. It's colony forming. That's one big organism. So if you cut back a little bit, it's just going to feed itself
going.
From the part you don't cut back or from the root reserves. So, again, some of those triclopyr-based herbicides like Garlon 4 and Pathfinder 2 are very good at working through that whole root system and killing off the whole root system instead of just one. So you cut those stems, you treat it. You can, if you cut it all down or mow it down, let it sprout up for a couple weeks. You can also do a foliar application while it's short, you know, a foot high or so. But we find we use the least herbicide if we're cutting and treating. Now, again, on a scale, you might not be able to do that. You might have half an acre and you have to mow and treat. Honeysuckle, you know, I find it, as far as brush goes, a fairly easy one to control in that spectrum of brush. We actually prefer to use the glyphosate herbicides, again, concentrated about one-to-one mix, concentrated one-to-one with water, and treat the stumps with that. It dies very easily. It's very strongly impacted by glyphosate. And, again, it's a matter of cutting them and treating the stumps. And, again, if you have to, you can mow a patch of it and spray them after they resprout. But less herbicide, the better.
There you go, Chris. Thank you so much. Patricia wanted, I think she called or emailed to say that she tried growing prickly pear from seed but had a lot better luck getting the pads from Prairie Moon.
There you go.
So Prairie Moon is...
If they have them, yeah. Sure.
If they've got the pads, you're going to have a lot better luck from that. Well, you know, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much, Frank, for being with us today. And again, March 10th, you're going to be talking at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison.
Planting a prairie, yep.
Planting a prairie. Our guest today, Frank Hassler, owns, and he's the chief ecologist for Good Oak Ecological Services. He's also president of the Madison chapter of the local Wild Ones. I'm Larry Mueller, and you're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network.